You're listening to the Bliss Runner Podcast, episode number 17.
Then I heard the quote by Gandhi, who said, "First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win."
This podcast is for any woman who has ever had a challenge in her sex life. Whether you've lost interest in sex in your long-term relationship, orgasms have become elusive, or you've just been longing for something more, something deeper that you can't quite even articulate, this podcast is here to help. In this show, we'll explore how you can transform your experience of sex by learning the subtle art of awakening your sexual energy. Now, this is not just woo-woo stuff. It's tangible, and it's having a profound effect on women's lives. We'll hear stories by women like you and me who've moved from lack of sexual enjoyment to incredible, expanded, ecstatic states by accessing this energy inside. We'll also talk to authors, teachers, and practitioners in the field for guidance on how you can get started on this deeply gratifying journey. I can tell you that it has completely changed my life, and I know it can enrich yours. I'm really glad you're here. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Bliss Runner Podcast. Today, I'm bringing you the first part in a two-part interview with Marilyn Milos. She's the Executive Director of Genital Autonomy America, and I have to tell you, I love this woman. I have so much respect for what she has done. She is basically the founding mother of the movement for genital autonomy. And we discussed today the very difficult topic of genital mutilation. Now, when I say those words, probably in your mind, you're conjuring an image of a ritual that happens somewhere in a third world country, very far removed from our experience. But the truth is that we have normalized in this country, the United States, a form of genital mutilation. We just call it circumcision. But it happens every single day. The work that Marilyn does is to bring consciousness to this very important issue. She is hoping to educate parents so that they make the choice to allow their babies genital autonomy, to make this important decision for themselves when they are old enough to make this decision, rather than making this decision for them when they're born. Before I get into this first part of the interview with Marilyn, I wanted to just share with you why it is that I care so much about this subject. I, like so many other women who were raised in the 60s and 70s, was pretty ignorant to the issue of circumcision until later in life. In other words, every little boy's penis that I had ever seen was circumcised, including my brother's, and I just didn't know there was any other way. When my baby brother was born, when I was 8 years old, he was brought home from the hospital, and I saw the wound around his penis when I was changing his diaper, and I asked my parents about it, and they explained that his foreskin had been removed and that it was just something that happened to everybody. They didn't explain any more than that, so that's what I filed away in my brain. And then when I became sexually active, of course, I was only exposed to men who had been circumcised. Virtually, it was so prevalent in my generation that it was rare to find someone who had not been circumcised. So in my mid-20s, I happened to see a program on television, which we'll be talking about in the interview, where the issue was raised, and the panel discussed the fact that this was not something that's done everywhere, that in fact it's not medically necessary, and it's that, you know, they discussed the various reasons that are usually given for doing it. When I became aware that it was not necessary, I was horrified and enraged, and just couldn't imagine making the choice to amputate a part of an infant's body without their consent. It blew my mind to think that we in this, what I think of as a civilized country, would ever do this to another human being. There's no other part of the human body that we would ever consider cutting off at birth, or at any other time before that person can consent to having that part removed. So just on a basic human rights level, I was horrified and touched very deeply by what I saw as just a grievous injustice. And then, as if learning about this basic violation of the human right to bodily integrity weren't enough, then I learned about the other horrors of this procedure, such as the many irreversible complications, you know, things going wrong with the procedure itself, botched circumcisions, problems with penile function going forward, and the horrors of the procedure itself. It was revealed that for many, many decades, babies were not anesthetized, so they felt excruciating pain during this entire procedure. And that, you know, we go into detail about that in this episode. And even when anesthesia is used, the baby is not spared from suffering. It has to endure being strapped down to a board and the struggling that it goes through to try and get free, as well as the pain and discomfort of having its glands exposed to the elements. The glands is the foreskin is adhered to the glands when the baby is born, and they have to rip it away from the glands in the same way that you would have to rip a fingernail from the bed of your fingernail. And the tissue underneath the glands, the tissue of the glands is similar to the very vulnerable tissue underneath your fingernail, and it's very, very painful to have that tissue touched in any way. So over time, of course, the penis builds up a thick layer of calloused protection because of this fact. But for the healing period, it's very painful. And that is what this baby is exposed to immediately after they're born. So the trauma to the babies physically and the psychological after effects of subjecting an infant to this kind of physical trauma are, we haven't even begun, I believe, to fully understand the long-term ramifications of this procedure. The intact penis is the easiest thing to care for. You just don't have to even worry about it. There's nothing that needs to be done. It's not unclean. It's not a bacteria breeding ground. It's a self-cleaning, beautiful, functioning part of the human anatomy. And so I'm just hoping that more and more parents will make the decision to leave their child intact. It's so easy to make that decision. So I vowed that I would never have a child circumcised if I ever had a boy. And that is, in fact, later in life, I had my first child, and I chose to keep him intact, which itself was a bit of a process just to ensure that that happened. And then in my 30s, I got further into the issue when I began to experience some recurring abrasions during as a result of sexual activity. I was with a partner who whose circumcision had been so, I guess, tight that the area of pubic hair at the base of his penis, that skin with all of the pubic hair, would be drawn up the shaft when he became erect. And the hair just became like sandpaper to my tissues, and it resulted in open bleeding sores, you know, that just would never heal because the tissue inside, you know, the labia are just so tender, and no amount of, you know, hair removal efforts seemed to take care of the problem. So I did some research at that time when this was happening to me, and I read more and more about these kinds of side effects, if you will, of circumcision. And I was even more horrified then, just because it was something that was affecting men on many levels that they didn't even realize, and affecting their sexual partners in ways that they didn't even realize. So I then was learning that there are that there was a function to that foreskin beyond just being extra skin, which was how it was explained to me, that in fact it was not extra at all, that in fact it was one of the most important pieces of the sexual response for the man, and also a very vital piece of the sexual experience for the woman. And taking it away results in a huge number of problems for both parties. So when I realized this, I went through a deep grieving process, realizing that I was likely never to experience sexuality in the way that nature intended it. So that last reason, of course, is why I feel most compelled to include this topic in the material that I write about and talk about on my website, because my hope is to help individuals realize their potential for ecstatic bliss, for energetic, orgasmic bliss. And it becomes more difficult to achieve that goal when you have this obstacle to work around. The normal functioning of the pleasure response in the man and in their partner is interrupted by what has been done to the penis through circumcision. So there are ways to work around this, but we shouldn't have to. So if I can contribute in some small part to help future generations not have to deal with this this horrible problem, then I will feel that my work has been done. And on that note, let's get right into this interview with Marilyn. Hello, Marilyn. I'm so happy to have you here today.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be with you.
If you could tell us, first of all, just what it is that you do now, and then a little bit of the history. Let's go back in time to when you first started doing this work.
All right. What I do today is I'm working to end the genital mutilation of children, infants and children. And we call it female genital mutilation if it's done in Africa. We also do it here. When circumcision began, it was done to both boys and girls in the Western world and for medical reasons. And protecting boys, we call it circumcision here in America. And protecting intersex children, who most people don't even know about, but are as commonplace as in any society as redheads, which means it's 1-2% of the population. Mm. And some children are born. We have all male at one end of the spectrum and all female at the other. To assume that there are no variations in between those two is to greatly limit the nature of the universe. You understand?
Right.
So there are children who are born with both male and female attributes, and up until recently, these children have grown up having lived their lives with surgeries, secrecy, and shame, and their gender annihilated, and they've been forced into a gender that they not of their choosing and with genitals that have been altered and are often not functional. So the reason I've done this, because when I first began my work, it was just simply I witnessed a circumcision in an American hospital, and I was so horrified by what I saw happening to this baby and the reaction to the baby after the scream, baby screaming for 15 minutes until there was no more voice. And then the doctor had looked at me and said, there's no medical reason for doing this. Well, that was the moment that changed the course of my life. At any rate, so I started working just to protect boys, recognizing how horrible that was. And then began to meet women who had been mutilated as well. And they told me their stories. So how could I not fight for them as well? And then at my last symposium, my 13th symposium, I'm working now on the 15th. But I do these international symposia. Ida Valoria, a beautiful woman who has just written a book. It's just been released, called Born Both, An Intersex Life. Mm. And she spoke, and she talked about nobody ever did surgery on her. So she's one of the few unique intersex people who you can see within her has both male and female attributes, has lived her life as both. And very interestingly, so, which she discusses and describes in her book. And and she said, she put her hands up in the air. She said, I'm who they're trying to change. At the end of after she said that, I said, I want what you've got. but she's so beautiful and so full. And, you know, in some societies, societies, intersexual women have been revered. Whereas, for example, a Liberian man who was also speaking at that symposium said there are no intersex children in Liberia. And I said, why not? And he replied, it's more embarrassing to have an intersex child than a dead baby. Whereas in Malta, a very small island along the boot of Italy, there was an intersex person who pushed, involved in the government, and they outlawed surgical cutting of intersex children, trying to change them to be something else. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. and they've outlawed that, but in the process of protecting intersex children, they protected all children. So my idea here is that if we lump all children together, males, females, and intersex, I'm certainly not a lump, but you understand.
Yes, bring them become together, all-inclusive, yes.
And raise consciousness about all these children have a right to their own body till they grow up. If they choose circumcision from themselves, that's their choice, and I'll support it. I might tell them how stupid their choice is, but I will support it. I mean, most people want all the sex organs they've got, you know, and most men want all the penises they've got if given a choice. So best to leave them alone until they grow up and make these choices about their own bodies. So that's the work I do now. And I changed the name of our organization from NoCirc, which is saying no to circumcision, in January last year. I changed it to Genital Autonomy America. There are genital autonomy organizations in Australasia, which means Australia and New Zealand and the islands around. It also means in England, Denmark, Finland, Germany, the Netherlands, throughout Europe, they're also working to end to protect the rights of all children.
And you've been doing this work for 39 years?
It'll be 39 years in May.
My goodness. I'll tell the audience that is as a result of the work that Marilyn does, I was first exposed to the issue. I didn't realize it was an issue until I was in my mid-20s. And then in 1987 or so, I saw the Phil Donahue show, and they discussed this. This was my first exposure to the issue. I'd had a baby brother who had been circumcised, and I remember, you know, a vague conversation with my parents, like, oh, you know, after he was brought home, I was 8. And so I saw him when he was brought home. I was like, what's wrong with his penis, you know, because it was bandaged and red and scabby and, you know. And they said, oh, that's just circumcision, and that happens to all boys, basically, is what they said. Mm. And so I just, you know, that's the last I heard of it. And then when I became sexually active, I was only with men who had been circumcised, and it just was not something that was ever questioned beyond that until I saw this program. And as soon as I saw the discussion about it, I was horrified. I was horrified. And I vowed, you know, from that point on, didn't have kids for another 15 years, but I knew for certain, as a result of the information that you shared, that I would never allow my son to be circumcised. And
oh, thank heavens. What a wonderful story. And thank you. I hope you understand how much that makes my heart sing.
Well, I can imagine how it would. And I'm sure that there are millions of women who can say that because of you.
Donahue put us on the map. He really literally put us on the map and got the news that he and Dina Dale. Those were the days when they were asking me to be on television. They were asking me to be on radio. And then later, all that quieted down. And I thought, what the hell is that about? Am I that unpopular, or I don't have a message anymore, or maybe it's my personality. I mean, you know, all the shit you go through. But anyway, then all of a sudden, there's nobody's calling me anymore. And then I heard the quote by Gandhi, who said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. And I thought, oh, that's when they were laughing at me. I was a person with a new message. I stuck my head above the horizon, and they were laughing. They were throwing shit at me. They were, you know, tomatoes and epithets and so on and on. So, and then I thought, well, we're not there anymore. Now they're fighting us, and they still are. Of course, what's going to happen is now that we're getting to the second and third generations of intact boys who are normal, healthy, whole, happy, and kind, gentle human beings, they're becoming the doctors, the lawyers, the jurors, the ethicists, and so forth. And we're going to begin to see a difference. But yeah, you got the idea.
So can you tell us a little bit about the numbers? Do you have any idea how much they've gone down since,
in terms of the rates since I began?
Yes.
The circumcision rate when I began was 85 to 95%. And today we're about, it's about 56% nationally. But in the western states here, which is California, Oregon, Nevada, and Washington, we're less than 20%. Nevada is amazing; it's less than 12% now.
Wow.
So we're winning the West, and we'll win the Midwest is a hard one because they don't have, they're in the center and they don't have exposure to new ideas. The way the people on the coast with the influx of immigrants and so forth, we see variations. We don't just see all white or all this or all Presbyterian or all whatever, you see the whole melting pot, which is really wonderful. It gives you an advantage in terms of acceptance of humanity in its wholeness.
Yes. And so for those who are not as familiar with, say, the international, or the rates of circumcision internationally.
The people in the world when your parents say, "Oh, this is just what's done for boys," and this happens to all boys, well, it doesn't. Probably more than two thirds of the males on the planet have all the penis that they were born with. So who doesn't? Basically, the Jews, the Muslims, and the North Americans.
Right, and the rest of the world. We're not just talking about undeveloped countries. All civilized countries other than ours have very low circumcision rates. Is that correct?
Yeah. I'll give you good news. There are now about 2,000 families in Israel who have kept their sons intact.
Wow.
And the beauty of that, you see, the fear has always been that these babies will be cut off from their people.
Mm-hmm.
But now they're being included, and there are two beautiful women in America. These two women wrote a book called Celebrating Brit Shalom. So instead of cutting, they have a beautiful naming ceremony, and they welcome the baby into the world and into the family, into the community, into the culture without any cutting. And I've been to a couple of these, and there was music played. L'chaim, it was one they played when the baby was not circumcised at the time that he might otherwise have been circumcised. And they have the first one that I went to, there wasn't a dry eye in the room except for the baby who was smiling, and everybody else was weeping because he had been spared. So these women wrote the book called Celebrating Brit Shalom, because this was Lisa's brainchild, and she went to her synagogue and she said, are we going to be inclusive? Are we going to allow Jewish families who've chosen not to circumcise their baby to be part of the synagogue? And the rabbi said, of course that we will be inclusive. So she's gone about this to her. This is the only way you can, is that the families will make the choice, but we have to include them. So these baby boys are not being cut off from their people. They're being welcomed. Isn't that great?
That is wonderful. Can you go back and tell us your own very first exposure to the issue of circumcision?
My boyfriend and I were dating. I was 17 and he was 19. I was a senior in high school, just about to graduate. And I just turned 17. And at one point or another, I guess late at the end of that summer, he said to me, I need to tell you something about myself. I'm not circumcised. I had never heard the word before. I didn't know what he was talking about, but I was young. Mm-hmm. I was shy and I didn't want to appear stupid. And I didn't ask, but I got that he was uncomfortable with something about himself. And so I said, that's okay. I love you just the way you are. Mm-hmm. That passed. Nothing was ever said. I didn't hear the word again until about a year and a half later when we'd gotten married very, very young to get me out of the house away from an abusive father. Mm-hmm. And then we were sitting in the doctor's. I was pregnant with our first son. And the doctor said, if it's a boy, do you want to have him circumcised? And I looked at my husband. There was that word again. Mm-hmm. And I looked at my husband and he said, he started to say something. And just as he was ready to say something, the doctor said, it's cleaner, it's healthier, and it will protect your son throughout life.
Mm.
And my husband turned away from looking at me and turned to the doctor and said, yes, we want him circumcised. And I thought later, now he's dead, I can't even ask him, but I think that he was shy and self-conscious. I mean, clearly he said he'd made mention to me that he wasn't circumcised, thinking maybe that would make a difference, as if maybe it would have, I'd known what it meant, but I had no preconceived right. ideas at all. And when we got married, I still didn't know, because he was my first lover and my first husband, and he had what he had, and we did what we did, and it was just what we did.
Right.
So now here's the word again, and I didn't know. And when my baby came back to me, here comes the baby with a clamp on his umbilicus and a clamp on his penis, and that's how I thought babies came. And I learned nothing until in 1979 when I witnessed the circumcision and saw the horror of what my precious babies had experienced, and realized the doctor had lied to me and that I had made a huge, huge mistake.
So I want to talk about so many aspects of this. I think okay. that where we need to go next, I think we need to first talk about, you know, let people know more about what circumcision is, how it's done. I mean, okay. we understand right. the after effect, you know, that it's not there. But okay. I think people need to
That's
know more
it.
About
That's exactly right. You're right.
They know, need to know how we get there and why right. we are talked into getting there, and what the truth is about those justifications and the mm-hmm. history, basically. So if you could just go back to maybe that day that you witnessed your first circumcision to know what it is.
The day that I first witnessed a circumcision was, I was a nursing student at the College of Marin in Marin County, California, it's in the Bay Area. And, because I'd been told circumcision, my doctor had told me it doesn't hurt, as I said previously, that doesn't hurt, it only takes a minute and will protect your son's life. And that's what I was thinking was going to happen. So when our nursing instructor said we would see a witness a circumcision that morning, I didn't think very much of it, except that, oh, it's another procedure we get to witness. And when we walked into the nursery, the baby was strapped, so all the babies are around in this nursery, but on the countertop was a baby strapped at 4-point restraint on a circumstraint. It's a plastic board that is shaped, molded like a baby, except that the hips are elevated to put the penis closer to the doctor's face so that they can cut it better. Mm. and it's got 4-point restraint. It's got Velcro straps through these little holes in the thing, and in the board, in that plastic board, that strap over the baby's arms and legs. Many mothers said to me later, why did my baby come back with bruises on its arms and legs? He was just a newborn and he didn't have them before. Oh. how do you tell the mother that he was fighting so hard to save himself? So at any rate, so this baby's there, he is strapped 4-point restraint, and I'm seeing him, he's struggling, and he's doing what I would be doing. I mean, that's the thing, is it? Why did I have the empathy and the compassion when everybody else just stood there and looked? And I said to my instructor, can I go help him? Because this baby is going, and getting more and more frantic as he's trying to free himself from these restraints. And she said, oh, no, wait till the doctor gets here. So I look over at the doctor who's scrubbing, and he's telling a dirty joke to one or two of the nurses that are standing around listening. Ha, ha, ha. And which is very not uncommon, because they're doing surgery on a baby's penis and they're altering his sex life for the rest of his life. And nobody is addressing that. So they tell jokes. They talk about other things, or there's crude innuendos while this is going on.
It's a defense mechanism to separate them from the horror of it. Yeah,
absolutely. To distance oneself. Exactly. Mm. So I asked if I could, and so then fortunately the doctor came right away, because I couldn't have contained myself. And I thought, this is supposed to be a nursing profession. This is our nursing instructor, and she's telling me to wait till the doctor gets there. Disempowering me, disempowering the baby, and giving the power to the doctor. Well, the baby is the one who's hurting. And I'm thinking, something is really wrong here. So when the doctor came in, I said, may I go comfort the baby? He said, yes, go stick your finger in the baby's mouth, which I did. I thought, he doesn't know where my finger's been, fortunately. I'd washed my hands. And I put my finger in the baby's mouth, and he started to suckle, and I started to rub his head gently. And I just said, oh, sweetie, this is going to be okay. It's not going to hurt. It's only going to take a minute, and it will protect you through life. And I'm just talking to him as he calms down, and he's just settling in. And then the doctor begins. They've already done a betadine scrub. Oh, let me say this, Susanna, because this is troubling but excruciatingly important. It's before they do a circumcision, they have to scrub, as with any tissue, they scrub with a betadine solution, which kills all the bacteria. And that's so that the bacteria doesn't go into the body and cause sepsis.
Right.
We keep the bacteria out of the body. Mm-hmm. So it's on the body, but it's not to be in it unless it's in the GI tract, which is still out of the tissue where it causes, where bacteria cause problems. So, they do the scrub. And the scrub and scrub and rub a dub dub around and round and round this baby's little penis. And when you rub erectile tissue, what does it do? It becomes erect. Mm. This is the first shared sexual experience of this baby's life. And the next thing that happens, and here I am telling the baby, this is not going to hurt. It's only going to take a second. And then the doctor comes in, and with one hemostat, he clips on. Well, you know what a hemostat is?
Yes, I do.
Okay, and it's funny because some people don't know what it is. I say, like, it looks like a roach clip, you know, those scissor-like roach clips. Mm-hmm. Everybody gets it, you know what I mean? It's funny. at any rate, he clipped it at the foreskin two places, at 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock, if you're looking at it head-on.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, the head of the penis is called the gland, so I should say glands on. If you're looking forward at the penis.
Your glands on.
These two clamps go on, and that it's a ratchet, so it clamps onto the tissue. Where they're clamping is at the tip of the foreskin, where all the majority of nerve endings in the penis are in that part of the penis. Mm. So they've clamped on it, and that baby lets out his when he let out that first scream, he let go of my little finger with his mouth, and that was it. It never came. I never felt those lips again. Yeah. And for 15 minutes, he screamed. And there was no consoling him. The pain was just absolutely too great. So once they get those two ratchet things on, hemostats, then they hold those in one hand and they take a third one, or either a hemostat or a blunt probe,
mm-hmm.
and they have to stick it between the foreskin and the glands, the head of the penis, because it's attached, that these two structures are attached like a fingernail is attached to the fingernail bed.
Right.
And they have to tear the two apart. So they're really skinning the penis alive. And once they've done that, then they take that third hemostat, and put it at 12 o'clock and clamp all the way down the foreskin, until it reaches the other side of the glands, where it's attached. And the reason they do that is because they're crushing all the blood vessels and nerve endings so that when they cut it, it won't bleed. The baby won't bleed out. It doesn't take much blood for a baby to lose it all. Mm. So, because they don't have very much. So I think it's 4 ounces or something like that, or 6 ounces. Anyway, it's small. So they cut lengthwise. And the reason they have to do that is in order to insert the device that will go between the foreskin and the glands to prevent the whole tip of the penis from being cut off, they place this device. It's either a Plastibel or a Gonco clamp device. And each one works a little bit differently. But they both do the same thing. They're supposed to be there to protect the glands. It usually works. Sometimes it doesn't. And their hunks and slices are missing off men's penises because of it. Mm. Then they have to crush the foreskin over that, which they do, and then they amputate it. So you can see this is a very long, detailed thing. And I can tell you that any person, Fran Porter years ago, did a study about a baby screams during circumcision. And I can tell you that any person who hears the screams can tell you where in the process of circumcision they are, because you can tell where it's what's more painful and what's less painful.
Uh-huh.
Anand and Hickey studied circumcision and pain in neonates and fetuses. They looked at how pain affects them, and basically they use circumcision to determine what it is, and they saw that the cortisol levels are higher than the highest rates of cortisol levels in adults for little tiny babies.
Oh,
we know.
My goodness.
I mean, you know that commercial that has "This is your brain" and "This is your brain on drugs" when they throw the egg in the frying pan.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
That's what the cortisol levels do to this baby's developing brain so early in life, and it does make changes, and we know it's been documented, anyway. So
yeah, we'll get to some of that for sure.
Yeah, so all of that's happened, and the whole thing, by the time you get to the end, the baby is just spent. Often there's, by the way, some babies didn't scream out like that. Some babies just go inside themselves. You know, if two adult men have an accident, say a finger gets cut off, one may scream out and run around like a chicken with his head cut off, and the other one may just sit down, pull himself inward, going into shock or just shutting. That's his way of handling it. Babies do the same thing. So when those parents say, oh, my baby didn't cry at all, well, it's because he's in shock and the parent doesn't even know that. I mean, the thing is that I've said for many years, if circumcision were done in the hallways instead of behind closed doors, it would end tomorrow because parents couldn't stand it. I mean, I would think they couldn't. But
Right. I know I couldn't. I mean, I can't even stand to hear about it, much less. I was one of those attachment parents who couldn't let my kids cry it out at night.
Me
I had
either.
To go in every single time. Well, so.
But if you let that, if you wait till they're ready. They don't spend the rest of their life wishing for or that doesn't become an issue for them. They've had that's all been taken care of, and we're not attachment to parenting doesn't raise children who need psychiatrists later. You know what I mean?
I hope you're right. Yeah, I can see. Yeah, well, that's a whole nother conversation, I suppose. But yes, I think that responding to the baby's cries is the most natural. I mean, I can't imagine a parent who wouldn't. But I have to ask a question probably that a lot of people are wondering, and I certainly always have. Why don't they anesthetize the baby's penis before?
Well, they have begun to. They have begun to, but it wasn't until 1989. Now, every mother knows that you stick a baby with a diaper pin and he screams. You know babies feel pain. Why doctors said that? Well, here's why I think they said it is because circumcision became really popular after World War II. Why? Now all these mothers are having their babies in the hospital. I remember a friend of mine is a midwife, and she was married to an obstetrician whose father was an early obstetrician in the early 1900s. He and his cronies sat around wondering how to make money off of childbirth, and they said, let's get women into hospitals. So by the end of World War II, 1945, women were birthing in hospitals. And so doctors not only had access to the mothers, they had access to the babies. And by now, we had already perpetuated the idea that circumcision is cleaner and healthier. So doctors could do that too. And I read where doctors said, so if the baby is a sleepy baby, just take him across the room and circumcise him right then. He'll wake right up. So you had that. But mothers were anesthetized for their childbirth. And often that's what would happen. They'd come out with these sleepy babies because the babies are anesthetized too. And they didn't feel their circumcisions. They weren't crying. Probably had something to do with it. That was part of it.
I see.
So, of course, it was done behind closed doors. And then mothers were having natural childbirth. And it was during the 60s that mothers began to say, wait a second, what are we doing? And began to change. Now, I witnessed a circumcision. It was 1979. So there had been a few people who had been speaking out when I started, maybe a handful, but nobody took it on like I did, I guess. I just talked faster and unrelentingly. So,
well, thank God for the rest of us. So you've painted the tragic picture of how the procedure is done. Tell us more about the rationale. I mean, cleaner, safer, what was it?
Well, I just said it didn't hurt. It only took a minute and it would protect them from everything. But more than that, how this happened was it was in the mid 1800s in England where medicine was a new field. And it was in the late 1800s that we had medical schools, but medical schools did not let women in. So women were not allowed in medical schools. Mm-hmm. And it was, and throughout history in Europe, Jews have been persecuted, as you well know, as we all well know. And, who attended the medical schools? It was the brightest and the wealthiest amongst us. And that was the Jews in Europe. So, least they could afford to get themselves to the schools, and they were smart. So it was the Jewish doctors, and this sort of all dovetailed with Victorian England, mm-hmm. where sex was being repressed, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that. But the idea was what the notion came that if you overexerted your energy, you would deplete it and you would get sick. So masturbation was considered to be something that would do that, overextend your energy, and you shouldn't masturbate because you would get sick. Hmm. So circumcision was done to prevent discourage children from masturbating. They were cutting off. See, the doctors in the 1800s knew what the best part was. They knew it was. They knew it was that the nerve endings were not in the glands or the shaft of the penis. They knew that the nerve endings were in the foreskin, and that cutting it off would then decrease the pleasure of masturbation. No, it made men try harder to masturbate, trying to achieve what they should have had. The sensations and the orgasms that they should have had, that were their birthright to have. Mm-hmm. And that was cut off. And so if you want to know what the foreskin feels like, and by the way, the nerve endings in the foreskin are like the nerve endings in the fingertips. The foreskin is the finger. They're the lips of, it's the lips of the penis. It's like our lips also, when you see a sexy movie, how people lick their lips, you kind of run their tongue around their lips. What they're doing is running their tongue along the line of Meissner corpuscles nerves. They're these highly sensitive nerves. Again, like you, with your fingertips, you can, you know where the splinter is, even if you can't see it, you know, you can feel where it is. So those are the kinds of nerve endings, and they encircle the opening in what John Taylor identified, this band tissue. And he said there are 12 to 14 ridges that encircle the opening of the foreskin. And he said, and the nerve endings there are not in the valleys, they're in the ridges. Because what happens when the penis becomes erect, the foreskin is sort of drug outward. And so that the inner lining of the foreskin becomes the shaft of the penis. And all of those nerve endings are exposed to the vaginal walls. So the foreskin, the penis is stimulated by the nerve endings going across the corona, the widest part of the head of the penis, going across the corona, and then again by the vaginal walls, and then as the male withdraws, the foreskin goes back over the glands again, stimulating it again. And that rolling mechanism and that gliding mechanism work wonderfully for both the male and female in normal sexual relations.
Right.
Much different experience.
So we were talking about the rationale. So the Victorian anti-sex, and they also, it sounds like, had a little bit of a a theory about energy usage.
Exactly. And then it came from there. It went from England. So they'd begun circumcising in England specifically to prevent masturbation or to curb it it was done to both boys and girls, but more they started using carbolic acid and things like that, sort of blistering the clitoris rather than amputating it. Although Blue Shield and Blue Cross paid for clitoridectomies in America until the late 1970s. So it was done to both children, and I've met several women who grew up in America and were clitoridectomized at the age of one, two of them at the age of three, and the other at the age of 12. She was in a girls' school, a Catholic girls' school, and the nun said it was to the girls, it was a sin to touch themselves down there. She went in and said to the nun, I've been sinning. I've been touching myself down there. And the next day she found herself in the hospital and was clitoridectomized.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So then when it came to America, we used the curbing masturbation partly, but also now we've adopted it along with cleanliness. Mm-hmm. It's cleaner. One of the reasons I think that the Jews have been able to circumcise for their babies for so long is because, and I've heard rabbis and moyles say to me, and also Jewish women, mothers, say to me, oh, you have to get rid of that disgusting thing. It stinks. It's smelly. I heard a rabbi say, and when I pull that foreskin back before I circumcise that baby, there's all this stinky stuff underneath. I'm thinking, this is in his mind. This is not reality. Mm-hmm. Because if you pull your fingernail away from the fingernail bed, if you've ever had that happen, what you see under it, you see little blood perking up and little blood droplets of blood and little white droplets, which are probably lymphatics. That's what you see. And that's what you would see when you tore the foreskin from the glands. The same thing, not smelly smegma or Nothing in the imagination like these people think. But what I get from that, what I glean from that, is that in order to do something so grotesque to a baby, you have to make the part that you're cutting off even more grotesque than the act of doing it.
I see.
So we've had a malign foreskin year after year after for millennia now. And so in America, well, we're going to get rid of it because it'll be cleaner, it's healthier. You don't have to wash under there. I can tell you that to wash under a foreskin, it takes less time than it takes to wash behind the ears or to brush the teeth. And if it takes any longer, it's usually accompanied with a smile.
Yeah. certainly takes no longer than it takes us to wash our own genitalia.
Absolutely.
Women.
Absolutely. We have many more folds. For male, it's retract, rinse, no soap because it's
right.
It's mucosal tissue. Retract, rinse with your fingertips and replace it and leave it alone. That's
yes.
it.
And that's once they're adults, right? So let's as long as you're mentioning retraction,
puberty.
when they're little, you don't have to do anything. You know,
you really don't have to do anything.
Yes, you can't.
When they're little, you wash the penis like you wash your finger from the body outward. That's it. Wash mm-hmm. it. Body outward and leave the rest alone. And boys fiddling and so forth. The foreskin and the glands, as I said, are attached at birth. And between birth and puberty, the foreskin will become retractile. Probably 50% of boys at the age of 15 have a fully retractile foreskin. Mm-hmm. And the average age for foreskin retractability is 10.4 years. The American Academy of Pediatrics in their latest position statement said the foreskin is retractable by 3 months of age. This is a fallacy, and it is dangerous information.
Right.
Nobody should hear that. And people now are forcibly pulling the foreskin back because of that information.
And I imagine that causes scar tissue.
Of course it does. But 98% of 18-year-olds have a fully retractile foreskin. So it's the hormones of puberty and the increased interest in the organ at hand mm-hmm. that finishes the job. Now, the man who headed our NOCIRC of Illinois was 25 years old, was going to get married. And his foreskin, he had a pinpoint opening, which like you see in infancy, in a mm-hmm. newborn.
Yeah.
Pinpoint opening and had never been able to retract it. But he decided he wanted to have a fully retractile foreskin before he got married. So every day he began gently stretching. And he uses, first of all, use one little fingertip that could kind of force it in. And then it would be two. And it took him about 4 months, gentle stretching. And when I say gentle, I mean gentle, because anytime you're hurting yourself. Anytime you're feeling pain, that's causing damage. So mm-hmm. he very gently stretched the tissue. And it took him, he said, somewhere between the fourth and the fifth month, his foreskin became retractable. That was 50-something years ago. He's never had a problem. It was retractile then, and it's been retractile ever since. So gentle stretching can work for those men who for that 2% of men who don't have a fully retractile foreskin and want one. Or one man said to me, I've never been able to retract my foreskin. He said, but once a week, I get a little glass of warm water, and I stick a drop, just one drop of hydrogen peroxide in it, and I scoop it up into a bowl a syringe, and I squirt it into my foreskin, and then I squeeze it and just rinse it. And I said, well, you don't need the hydrogen peroxide. It's probably a terrible thing to be using.
I was going to say.
But if you've done this for the last 60 years, who am I to tell you to do it different? You know what I mean?
Right.
So if it's working for him, why would I tell him otherwise? However, I said he certainly doesn't have to use the peroxide. It's probably abrasive and not such a good thing. Kills the bacteria that you want to keep. They're the good things,
right?
Oh, God.
Yeah, you know, so, it's interesting. I had an adult male reach out to me through my website recently, who is not circumcised, but he said he was considering it because all the women that he dated, he said, had trouble with it. They
had
would
an
say
issue
things,
with it.
Yeah. They would
find
say
a European. You know, I say to women in America who want to find an intact man, listen for the accent. So I say the same thing. I say the same thing to him. Listen for an accent. Find a woman who's from Europe because she's going to love it and she's going to think she's struck gold in a circumcising society.
Yes. Well, I pretty much tried to tell him those kinds of things that, you know, listen. It's something that I wish all men were, and you know, talk to him a lot about the how lucky he is, you know, that he's left
absolutely
intact.
There is a great new survey. Well, it's not new. It's been going. It's been ongoing. Tim Hammond has done this. It's the Harm Documentation Survey. And if you want to, these are the men who are courageous enough to examine their own condition, to recognize what's happened to them, and to talk about it, to share what's happened to them, and to lament and to discuss what they're left with. This is not a benign surgery. Men are left with skin bridges and extensive scars and hunks and slices missing, and often premature ejaculation in early life and the end of life. You know, I ask octogenarians, how's your love life? And they say, oh, the urge doesn't come around as often as it used to, but it's every bit as good as it ever was. Those are the intact men. Circumcised men saved me what love life? I haven't had love life since I was in my mid-40s or my mid-50s or my mid-60s, somewhere along the line, because when you have amputated the foreskin and removed all that, not only all those nerve endings, denying a male the ride to orgasm, instead he goes over the cliff. Oops, honey, I'm sorry, I'm so sensitive. Anyway, these are the things that occur.
And that's where I would like to finish up for this part one of my interview with Marilyn Milos. Please join me for part two, which will be episode 18, where Marilyn and I will discuss the negative effect of circumcision on sexuality, not only on the individual who has been circumcised, but also on their partner. In the meantime, if you'd like to see the show notes for this episode, head on over to my website at www.blissrunner.com. I will include the links to the many books that Marilyn discusses in this episode, as well as links to her website and other resources for learning more about this important issue. While you're there, you can pick up a copy of my guided meditation called the Ecstatic Energy Meditation. This is something that I used that helped to kickstart my own experience of ecstatic orgasmic energy, and I want you to have it for free. Until next week, I remain blissfully yours.